Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. Tonight, Monday Night Philosophy has something different. We're actually going to delve into the most difficult areas of philosophy, although they're not any more difficult than any other. It's just a matter of clear conceptual thinking. So the first thing that I want to discuss and talk about is what's the goal, because it's very important when you're about to do something to kind of know what the goal is. So the goal in this case for me is to have as clear an approximate description of reality as you can get. I'm interested in reality. It would be nice if the world would conform to our imaginations. At least we think so. But actually, it would not be that good if it conformed to our imaginations. First of all, there'd be no coherence between all of our different imaginations. But, you know, when our imaginations are free is when we're dreaming. And I don't think too many people would really like, you know, our dreams to be reality. So it's important that we understand I'm not out to really be concerned about attempts to explain the world that don't make any sense. I admire people who have attempted to explain the world. But I think they need still to be very rational about it, to be persuasive. I mean, if I were standing here and I was 70 feet high and made out of blue light, and I was talking to you, I might get your attention. And if I said you have to vote Republican, I still think that there'd be a great deal of dissent in San Francisco, no matter what I look like, or so on. And so you basically need to test whatever anybody says, no matter what they look like, no matter what they have, with reason. And I was a very early adopter of this approach. When I was 5 years old, in November, I figured out and went to my mother and I said, you know, about this Santa Claus story. So, you know, in my hometown, there were about 80,000 people, and I had just discovered this. And I realized that, you know, going up and down a chimney takes at least a minute. And so I did some calculations, and I said, you know, I don't see how you can even do our town in one 24-hour period. I said, I know there's 24 hours. I'd also heard, you know, that the sun goes around, and so they had 24 hours. So I had this 24 hours and 80,000 people. I said, you know, I just don't see how we can do it. And she said, well, it's just not true. We do it. Just don't tell any of the other kids. I'm afraid tonight I'm telling the other kids about a bigger issue. So that was how I got started. And what's important, I think, about the whole subject, one of the things when in my 20s, one of the things that I realized was getting in our way was, it's been condensed by me into a maxim. So the trouble with trying to think clearly is that our emotional needs keep getting in the way. So the trick is to make thinking clearly an emotional need. Now, very few people have decided that thinking clearly is an emotional need for them. No, other things are emotional needs. But this is one of the things about me. That was one of the things that I found really interesting, that you could really think more clearly and actually come to a conclusion that you can use in your life. Use in your life. Not just for the abstractness of it, but you could actually use it. So that's the first thing. And part of my quandary in my early 20s when I was working on this project, my background was that I'd raised Roman Catholic. I had figured out in my teens that this sounded like a really good idea for trying to make people virtuous, but it didn't work. That people were pretty much the same as they'd been for the last thousands of years anyway. And then I studied Indian philosophy for several years, and I found that there was difficulty there. But I kept going back to something that I had read when I was 14, and that was by Plato in The Republic. He wrote that if you get your first principles straight, everything else falls into place. And so tonight, that's what I want to talk about. First principles, you'll find I don't digress too often. I mean, I digress all the time when I talk, but I don't digress too often into something that's not a first principle. So we'll talk about only the biggest issues in each of these attempts to try to explain life. So that quandary I was talking about was truth versus beauty. People talk about, you know, that life has to be beautiful. We want a beautiful answer to life. And so we kind of tend to lean towards beauty as opposed to towards the truth. Truth sounds stale and a little bit too harsh and stuff like that. And I realized, of course, that, not of course, but it just dawned on me after I'd been working on this for over a year, that my assumption and my leaning towards beauty rather than truth was a lack of faith in truth. I didn't really believe that the truth would turn out to be beautiful. And therefore, I was going with my, you know, what seemed beautiful to me and following that. And I said, okay, let's step back a bit and just go after what makes sense, what seems like a reasonable thing. Now, how do you know what makes sense or not? Well, first of all, we go back to Plato and Pythagoras, because both of them laid down a principle that we are now take for granted, and that is a concept. The concept is an inherent pattern in reality. We recognize that inherent pattern in reality using reason. Pythagoras got all excited about this because he discovered that there was a mathematical relationship in musical notes. He also realized that something that he had learned while he was in Egypt with the triangles could be put into a formula that was true at all times. That's the Pythagorean theorem, a squared plus b squared equals c squared. I won't go into the details of that, just to say it made him very enthusiastic about ideas. And then figuring out that an octave was in total harmony, that the length of the string was exactly twice as long to make an octave, and that if you divided it into mathematical relationships, you had all kinds of harmonies. This also he did, and also made him excited. In fact, he got so excited, he concluded that all is number, that everything is made of number. Now, that's a little bit too excited. Now, in general, I think this is one of the things that's important about studying ideas, is that even the best ideas are usually overused. In fact, the best ideas are often overused because they're so effective that you want to use them everywhere you possibly can. And so emotionally, we carry them further than they need to. But Plato, known as the heir of Pythagoras at the time, his time is 150 years later, he took that idea, all is number, and moved it into a different idea. And that idea is eternal ideas. It's eternal ideas theory that some of you have heard of. Most people are totally mystified by. I wonder what the heck he was talking about. But basically, that is a precursor to our simple concept, which is a concept. That is, it's an inherent pattern in reality. Now, I explain both Pythagoras and Plato because there's a lot of stories about them that they're sort of soaked in mysticism in addition to all this reason. But they were like the first amphibians. First amphibians walking out of the water are going to still be wet. So the first people to adopt reason as their approach for the big issues. Reason's been around forever. I mean, all animals use reason to figure out what they want to do. There's some seats up front here, too, if you want to. Yeah. So even animals will, you know, use reason. So reason is not an invention of the ancient Greeks. And reason, even it wasn't even the first time that reason was used to try to solve the biggest problems of life. Because there's some in ancient India and other places, too. But it was a really big boost. And what was really big about the boost was enthusiasm. Both Pythagoras and Plato were very enthusiastic. And where does enthusiasm come from? It comes from you have developed a passion for something because it produces happiness for you. Now, people don't really identify philosophers as very happy people. This is not exactly, you know, people think of more of very dour people and very, detailed and so on. But the truth behind philosophy is to be really passionate about something that gives you wisdom, that gives you happiness. That's what the ancient Greek tradition is, and there's a great power to that, and I hope you get a glimpse of that power tonight, because this is the 21st century version of exactly that power. It is having a passion for being able to figure out things and lay aside a bunch of ideas which scare us to no end and really don't make any sense whatsoever. And there's no reason to hold on to those fears if they really don't make any sense. So, that's the start. Now, most attempts at trying to explain something are not very effective. They're nice stories. Anybody that's made the attempt, you know, it's admirable to take your imagination, try to put a story together that will convince other people to explain life to everybody. But obviously, no one has been extremely effective at this because there's a lot of competing explanations and nobody can really buy into almost any of them totally. There are weaknesses and strengths in each of them, and I'm going to go into the biggest ones that are successful, but I'm not going to talk about the ones that haven't really approached rationality too much. You know, it's nice that, you know, the earth came because there was a big egg in the sky and it cracked and the yellow yolk became the sun. And so it's very nice and imaginative, but it really doesn't help us too much in figuring out what we should be doing with our lives. Right? So, the four categories or the four basic ideas that have come the closest, this is just my own analysis, are science, modern science, the absolute God theory, Plato's theory about the demiurge, and something called life as an eternal democracy, which we'll get to a little later. That's fairly new. So first, I want to talk about science. Modern science has a great strength. The great strength is that it relies on reason, measurement, and proof to move forward. Now, what a lot of people don't realize is that, or don't pay attention to, because popular science and the popularization of it appeals to our emotional needs even more than our intellectual needs to understand things. And so people kind of think that the ideas that are current, that everybody knows that those are actually facts. They're not theories, they're facts. But actually, science, almost every scientific theory that has even been popular has been overturned or modified over time. It's really pretty new. Newton is not that long ago, a couple hundred years. And Galileo and Copernicus before him getting this started. And that was a revival. Copernicus was called himself a Pythagorean. He was going back to Pythagoras and saying, you know, we're going to use this enthusiasm for reason. And he reasoned his way. You know, Copernicus's mathematics wasn't as good as his reasoning. So that was taken care of by other people later on. So I want to give you a good example of where the strength of science in measurement, proof, and reason falls down because of one thing, another idea that has been so successful that it just kind of overwhelmed everything, and that is the 20th century scientific myth that we can't know anything if we don't measure it. Okay? Because that limits. You cannot explain life. You cannot explain the world if you say, I can't really say anything about something unless I can measure it. It limits you tremendously. Now, I'll give you an example. There's the theory of the indestructible atom. This comes from ancient Greece. Okay? It's been around a long time. Lots of people have said this is one of the greatest, you know, ideas or conceptions, and it was just, you know, a philosopher sitting around thinking about what it was that must make up how things work. He said, if there's discreteness in this world, and there's lots of discreteness, it must be, it can't be that there's a continuum or a mush at the bottom of the whole thing. There must be discrete individual units, and those units must be indestructible in order to create the world of motion and continuum of change which we see all around us. So they picked that idea. Now, in the early 20th century, scientists said, oh, we've found the atom. We looked below the molecule, we found the atom, it's indestructible. That lasted about 10 years. And then they started pulling apart the atom. Right now it's Higgs boson. You know, we found the thing that fills in the standard model. But I think, and I'll make a prediction on this, the standard model, the Higgs boson and the 16 fundamental particles, which they now call fundamental, which are make up part of atoms, which make up part of molecules, will eventually become like the standard table for chemicals. You know, that it will be an array that matter often goes into, but there's nothing fundamental about it at all. There's nothing fundamental. But the Higgs boson lasts for a split second and only under very weird circumstances. That can't be something fundamental. It's certainly not indestructible. Okay? So, what would be an indestructible atom? So we use reason. We can't measure it. As a matter of fact, I think we'll never be able to measure the fundamental particle. And why? How do we measure anything? We measure things by bouncing millions of little things off of something that's bigger. That's how we see. We see with photons. But even when we go below a photon, we are using things that are smaller to bounce off something bigger in order to get some kind of an idea. If I wanted more information about that lady right there, I wouldn't take the lady over there and bounce her off of her and then see what information I would get. I wouldn't get much. They'd get bruised, but we wouldn't get much information. Now, if there was an indestructible particle that nothing can be smaller than, then the only thing that's smaller, you have nothing smaller than it to look at it. So you've run into a logical problem. The only way to see something is to bounce smaller things off of it and get some kind of an idea from it. And you can't because they're the same size. And so we'll never see the fundamental particle, but we'll still be able to know that it exists, first of all, from the logic of the atomic theory, but also it will act in a certain way. If it's indestructible, it can't heat up. Why can't it heat up? Because it doesn't have parts. Only things that have parts, internal parts, can heat up because the speed, the internal speed of those parts increases when you heat something up. An indestructible particle, an indestructible atom, cannot heat up. And therefore, whenever you impart momentum to a real indestructible atom, it can only take that momentum in two ways instead of three. The three ways are temperature, spin, and forward momentum. Right? So it cannot have heat. And so it will either have only forward momentum or spin. Now, those of you who are familiar with the uncertainty principle by Heisenberg, at that level, which is quadrillions of times smaller than the fundamental particles that are being looked at today. Quadrillions of times smaller. At that level, there's uncertainty about where you cannot identify exactly what the velocity is or the location of something at the same time because they affect each other when you look at it. Because what you're looking at, you're getting close. You don't know whether that's the fundamental level. But it's going to be smaller than that, the idea of the fundamental particle. The irony is on the other end of the spectrum, everythingness, which may be, you know, the concept of God in some theories, you know, that you can't see that either. Because there's nothing to bounce off of everythingness either, because there's nothing left once everything is there. So you're not going to be able to see or know that either, or ever be able to tell. So you have to reason your way through these things. You cannot get there by that. Now, a couple of other things about science, scientific ideas. One is that because it can only measure, it'll only talk about what it can measure, it won't deal with eternity. And we'll talk a little bit more about eternity later. But there is no way to take that concept into account if you have to measure it. But it's very clear that something has to be eternal. The conservation of mass energy says that nothing is created or destroyed. Everything is just being reorganized. And so inherent in the theories that we are operating with today, there is non-destruction, non-creation, only reorganization. And how do you explain that? Well, first, I can't go into this for very long. Last year I spent the whole hour in my lecture on time and eternity. But the basic concept is that we have time. And time is our measurement of change, measurement of the continuum of change. That's something we've made up. But the reality is that there's a continuum of change. And the continuum of change is caused by these most likely decillions of indestructible atoms moving relative to each other. And they're never all going to be moving in the same thing, so there's always going to be a continuum of change moving along. And what's eternal is what is uninfluenced by the process of change. Anything that's uninfluenced by that process of change means it's outside of that process, and what could that be? Well, one thing we would know is if the theory about indestructible particles is true, that they are eternal, their existence, each one. We don't know how many there are, but it have to be a set number. They can't be being increased or decreased. They have to be a set number. So that concept is something that we can reason our way through and get someplace. One of the things that's interesting about science, and one of its weaknesses, is it's emotional, ironically. But it's emotionally attached to determinism. And why is it emotionally attached to determinism? Ironically, it's because that way there's no responsibility. Determinism says that everything is caused by, you know, a previous cause and effect goes back and back and back, and there's an original cause, or, you know, that's a different argument, but there's never any explanation of eternity, and therefore there has to be a start. It's the Big Bang, and if we knew where every particle was at the first moment of the Big Bang, we could tell you the whole history of the universe. That's the basic theory of determinism. And ironically, I say that why is determinism emotionally appealing? Because we're all so afraid inside of the theory that we're responsible for all of our actions. And that comes from the religious theories. And so the fear that's ingrained in our culture of taking responsibility for your actions is actually the emotional cause of science going against this idea. There's another greater irony. And that is the second really big and successful idea is the theory that there's an absolute God in charge of everything. The reason I say it's ironic is this is also a deterministic theory. It's also, when you push it logically, you get to Calvin's approach, which is that it's all determined right from the start. God knows everything. He knew everything that was going to happen. He set it all up. It's all happening. And at the end, he knows what's going to happen. The whole thing, there is no free will. No free will. Okay? And I find that ironic because these are the two that are fighting with each other. But they both share a basic fundamental approach which seems to ignore the reality that we all make decisions. So, the other two theories, we'll go back and cover some more points of that a little bit later. But the other two theories take into account free will. And this is, you know, inside of a religious theory, free will is all involved with whether we're moral agents or not. And also to say that human beings have free will, but animals don't have free will. And there's a whole bunch of arguments about it. But this is not the first principle level that I'm talking about. What's interesting is that there is a qualitative difference between experience and existence. You know, atoms exist. Do they experience anything? We don't think so, right? We don't think that they have any minds. Maybe we'll find out sometime they do, but it doesn't look like it. Right now, genes are considered to be making all the decisions, but they don't seem to have any minds either. And so it's kind of a curious place to put the responsibility because, you know, it could be the blueprint for our bodies, but they don't seem to make any decisions. Who makes decisions? Every animal makes decisions. Every animal has a mind. They make decisions. Am I going to go here? I'm going to go there. I'm going to eat now. I'm not going to eat. They're making decisions. I'm not talking about whether they're moral agents and so on. Just, are they decision makers? And making decisions seems to be a qualitative difference from just existing. So, I make that distinction between the two, and now we'll go back to the third theory, which has almost no followers whatsoever, although it's been around since Plato, and that is his demiurge theory. He understood, even though he hated the theory of atoms, he didn't like this idea that there were indestructible atoms because he had a more mystical idea about the universe. But he gave in to the logic of it. He understood that the logic was powerful. And he said, if there are indestructible atoms at the base, then there is no creator. Because something has to be eternal. It's just as logical to say God is eternal as it is to say that the atoms, the indestructible atoms, are eternal. There is no real difference between making that argument, going back to the first cause arguments of Aristotle and the other ancient Greeks. There is really no difference between what you decide is eternal once you decide something has to be eternal, except for that you should be careful that whatever is eternal is not subject to change. Because if something is subject to change, it's not really eternal. That's a different animal. It's really two conceptions that we can make clear and divide up. So Plato decided that there must be, because looking around at the earth, as the creation theorists have it, look around and see all this intelligent design. And they say, you know, somebody must have done that. And so Plato said, yeah, somebody probably did that. But he couldn't have been an absolute God. He couldn't have been eternal. He didn't create it. He just reorganized it. So this has been reorganized for our benefit. But, you know, that's all. And he also said something which just killed his theory for any interest on. He said, but he wouldn't take any interest in us at all. So if he doesn't take any interest in us, you know, it's a little bit like if you had, you know, ants in your backyard. And you were watering the lawn and you suddenly noticed that the water was going to flood the anthill and you felt sorry for the ants for some reason. You walked over and you took your heel and you went like this and you put a line in the sand and all the water went like this and it went right around the anthill. All the ants came out and said, thank you very much for saving us. You know, what's the meaning of life? And you said, well, actually, it's gun control. We have to control all the guns. That's what we really need to do now. And then the ants, okay, great. And they could walk off, and 1,000 years later, there'd be some very strange idea that they would have, but they'd be so grateful that you saved them from dying that they'd pass this idea down. So, but you won't have spent any time thinking about that anthill for the rest of your life, even though they would spend all their time thinking about you. And in this case, that's what Plato said, and that's exactly why nobody ever adopted his theory, because this isn't what we need. We need somebody who pays attention to us. Even if it's just, you know, President Obama saying that he's paying attention to us, that's a lot better than, you know, somebody who's not paying attention to us, even if he's more important. So, emotionally, what are the needs that are involved? Well, I'll say something a little bit even more abstract. So, we'll get to the fourth theory, here, just briefly, and that's life as an eternal democracy. One of the things that must be true about an explanation of life, any explanation of life that's going to be successful, is that if there is eternity, that the meaning and the explanation has got to be inherent in the structure of life. It can't be temporally based. It can't say, move on. I'll move to the meaning of life and explain what I mean by that. There's a lot of different arguments about what the meaning of life is. You know, if you're a materialist and you're a boy, it might be that the meaning of life is that the boy who has the most toys when he dies wins, you know, as you will see on some yachts. So, because, of course, not only do they have a big toy there, but they also, you know, have a very important toy. And important toy, the importance of being important is a very crucial part of this approach. But there are all kinds of other explanations. And of course, the religious explanations totally disrespect the materialistic explanation, but it's very, very similar, actually. Because if you take that you're going to go to heaven as the meaning of life, that the whole purpose of your life is to go, oh, it reminds me. So when I was 6 years old, I was in church, just a raised Catholic, and I hadn't gone to my first communion yet. For those of you who know, at age 7, you get to go to your first communion. Before you go to your first communion and confess to God, you really, if you die, you kind of get to go to heaven automatically because you really haven't done anything serious enough to have caused him so much distress as to cause him to send you to the other place. And so that I was aware of, that if I died before I was age 7, I was going to get to go to heaven, free pass, basically. And I was in church and the priest was talking about being a missionary in Africa. And that if you died while you were a missionary, that you automatically went to heaven also. And he didn't say also, just automatically went to heaven. So I came home from church with my mother. And we got in the kitchen, we were starting to eat something, because of course, way back then, you couldn't eat before you went to church. So we were having breakfast, and I said to her, you know, I've got a great plan. I said, I want to go to Africa and be a missionary right now. Because if I get killed, I've got a double, you know, I've got a double ticket into heaven. Because I can get in on the under 7, and I can also get in as being a martyr missionary. And so, how could I ever be turned away with that double thing? And she said, that's not the way it works. And I said, no, no, no. You know, the priest said this, and the priest said that, and it adds up, you know, and this is my double thing. She said, that's not the way it works. Just stop thinking about it. That's not life. And, you know, as I say, you know, with my quote, her emotional needs were getting in the way of the reason. But I got a much better answer. Many years later, I told this story to a friend of mine in New York, a very conservative Catholic that I work with, and he said to me, George, sounds like you'd already reached the age of reason. You might have been 6 years old, but I think you'd already arrived there, so you wouldn't have gotten out on the one pass anyway. So, the meaning of life that comes from that is very important, because the meaning of life of this life, for a lot of people, is to get to heaven. Or the meaning of life of this life is to get to nirvana. Or the meaning of life is to merge with a god, if you're one of many gods in Hinduism that you want to merge with. Or the meaning of life is to get to nothingness. Or the meaning of life is to go to the Islamic heaven and have all the virgins and everything. So, a sensual pleasure. But all of those meanings, what do they all have in common that can't work? Every single one of them. So do it all at once. Don't have to discriminate. What? Reward. Well, they're all rewards, and we're going to go to that in just a second. But they all are temporary. They're all temporary. They're all pleasure. They're all happiness, too. But they're all temporary. Because when you get there, and you're in nirvana, or you're in heaven, whichever one it is, or you're in enlightenment, or you're in a union with a god, what is the meaning of your life then? You've already used up the meaning of life. Now you have to have a new meaning of life, because it's not inherent. It's temporal, and as soon as you get that one goal, it's done. It's a lot like our lives here. We go for a goal, and when you get that goal, there's a great rush of happiness, and then a couple of hours later, you begin to think what your next goal is going to be, right? And that's exactly, I mean, you can, if you read with that perspective in mind, if you read some of the great yogis and some of the great Buddhists who got to enlightenment and described enlightenment and everything, they had this big rush, and then later on, they, you know, it kind of wore away, and they said, I have to get that back. They spent their whole life trying to get that back. And why? Because they thought that they'd arrived because they got what was described. But it didn't last. And it doesn't last because nothing lasts. And so the meaning of life has got to be inherent in life. It can't be a temporal thing. And especially if there's eternal life. If we have a short life, all the more, not even as much. But if it's eternal, then certainly it has to be inherent in life. So the structure of the way we live life and what's inherent in our life is a crucial part of it. So, the inherent structure of trying to describe what's going on in life. A successful theory is going to be one that takes that into account, that just describes the way we experience life, the patterns in our minds. And unfortunately, which probably will make it unpopular, there won't be any distinction between human minds and animal minds or any minds. The cockroach mind works exactly the same way. When people, this is an aside, but going back to science, you know, the evolutionary theory is very popular. It was very popular in the 19th century, kind of mixed with the emotional need of the time that humanity was at the apex of creation, that we were doing a lot better than the dinosaurs and so on. But what people overlook, of course, is that the cockroaches haven't changed much in more than 100 million years. And the sharks haven't changed in 300 million years. So they maybe already reached the apex of evolution, don't have to change anymore. As far as they're concerned, that's their life is happy the way it is. So the popularization of a scientific idea often dilutes its effectiveness. Right? So the structure of any idea will have to be inherent in the way that we describe things, and I'll go back to that later. Now, one of the things that's interesting is that the emotional beliefs that we have don't really add up. One, you mentioned, rewards and punishments. We think that there's this theory of justice. Plato certainly wrote a lot about it. Everybody has thought, what's the theory of justice? What makes life just? And every single one, is it the theory of karma, or is it heaven and hell, punishment and reward? But actually, we punish and reward each other to try to make other people's wills conform to what we want them to do. And we just assume that God is going to do the same thing to us. This is what we do with our children, this is what we do with our colleagues, this is what we do with somebody that we want to marry us. We try to fool them into doing it, unless you're really confident. And you try to adjust the other people's wills through rewards and punishments all the time. Now, we assume that God is doing the same thing to us. But actually, there is no justice in the matter of rewards and punishments, period, because it never is in exactly the state of status. It's always like a pendulum. You're out of balance here, then you pull it back here, then you pull it back here. I think it's all just our attempt to adjust each other's behavior. We do this all the time, and I can't talk about it very long, but we do this all the time in our daily lives. We always want other people to see us in a way which we really aren't, because you know we look a lot better in our imaginations than in reality. And this is one of the reasons most people don't like to do public speaking, because you have 100 people all looking at you saying, yeah, he's, you know, not enough hair on top, you know, I don't like the tie, and so on and so forth. And everybody's always doing that when you're public speaking, and people who are sensitive to that find it really difficult to be in front of the public, unless you just say, well, everybody's going to be doing that, no problem. So accepting reality is quite useful under these circumstances. But in this case, the reality is that rewards and punishments can never, ever create justice. Karma will never, ever create any kind of justice whatsoever. Now, I think that there might be some inherent pattern in our minds, the way our minds work, that is the reason why we project out into the world and try to do this in the world of action. And that is that the quality of our emotions are exactly related to the quality of our desires. And if that's true, then internally there is justice at all times, and it never changes. But this needs to be explained in great detail, so we'll move on to something, you know, more first principle. So, rewards and punishments can't solve the problem. We say belief in God. It's a very interesting idea. In one of my books, The Gospel According to Andrew, I have Andrew the Apostle telling the stories from early Christianity. And he meets one of Paul's followers later in his life, and he says, what's this whole thing about believing in God? I don't understand what that means. Because why would God need you to believe in him for any reason? You know, what are you doing for God by believing in him? It's like Tinkerbell, you know, Tinkerbell, if Tinkerbell is dying and you get all the children, I believe in fairies, I believe in fairies, and then Tinkerbell comes back to life. If there is a God, you better not be dependent upon us all believing in him, because that would make him very weak. He can't possibly be dependent upon us. Of course, it sounds good to us emotionally, even if we don't think it through, if he were dependent upon us, because that puts us in charge. But you know, emotionally appealing and rationally speaking are two different things here. So another element to the whole theory most religions don't have the strict absolute God approach that logic demands. You know, logic demands, when you push forward this absolute God theory, that it has to be perfect. That God has to be perfect. Anselm said God is that than which nothing greater can be imagined or can exist. Okay? And therefore, nothing can be outside God. Everything, it has to subsume everything. There can't be anything, because otherwise you could say, it's God plus this is greater than God. Well, nothing can be greater than God, so it has to include everything. And the logicians argue about this, discuss it in India, in the Vedanta philosophy. They say, I am that, thou art that, all this is that. My question is, what is that? No? What is that that they're saying is everything? Because if it's just everything, it's all of reality. Now, one of the conclusions that these logical theorists have come to is that the world is an illusion. Right? In the Hindu theory, it's Maya. It's just an illusion. It's all Maya. And there's plenty of people in the West, mystics, that have come to the same sort of conclusion, the whole thing is an illusion. But because there can't be any differences in this state of perfection. The differences mar the state of perfection, so they have to explain it away. They explain it away with an illusion. But if you can see an illusion, then there's already differences. So that doesn't really take care of the question. So we go back to God's relationship with us. And what's fascinating to me is that we always look at it from our point of view. We never look at it from God's point of view. So let's look at it from God's point of view in a second. Look at it from our point of view now. Two really good examples of why our emotional needs worked versus something else going on in religion. One is that Paul, by St. Paul, by getting his theory in about salvation and that we're all corrupt sinners and that God took care of everything and that Jesus died for us, and so all of our karma or whatever you want to call it, all of our sins, all of our punishments are taken away. This was his personal need. And he expressed it as the whole theory about what it was, and it caught on like wildfire. It wasn't catching on that well before. But this appeals directly to our emotional need. We all want to be the center of the universe. Probably haven't noticed that. But all you have to do is go to a two-year-old, you know, group of two-year-olds, and you'll see that every single one of them thinks that they're the center of the universe. Of course, whenever they walk into a room, everybody is so delighted to see them that they jump up and down. Now, the kids that don't get over this become movie stars or politicians. You know, they want to walk in a room and have everyone go, whoa, you're here, John, you're here. It's wonderful to have you here. Now, don't ask me for money. No. So this center of the universe is implied in all of the theories that make us feel very comfortable. And if you have an idea that's not logical and not explainable from one point of view, but is explainable that it appeals to our emotional needs, I think you can kind of tell where it comes from. The other good example is Buddhism. Buddha said, all desire creates suffering. You have to get rid of all desire. That's basically saying human life is really a waste of time, you know, and you just get on with it, just get rid of all your desires, merge with nothingness, and that's done. Now, you can understand this was not very popular. For 300 years, almost nobody was a Buddhist. And then one of his followers created what they call the Great Vehicle Buddhism, in which there are bodhisattvas. Now, bodhisattvas are great. The idea of a bodhisattva is that it's an almost enlightened person, almost enlightened being, who then stops on the edge of going over the waterfall of enlightenment and turns back to all of us and says, I'm going to help you get here too. Does that make us the center of the universe? Absolutely. Is going over that waterfall supposed to be the meaning of life in Buddhism? Yes, that's the theory. Why are they not doing what they're supposed to be doing and instead turning around and helping us? Because it's our emotional need that that takes place. This is why Buddhism took off. Without the bodhisattvas, Buddhism would be nowhere still. And the same thing is true about Christianity. If you didn't turn around and tell the people that this you are the center of the universe emotionally, it would not ever be popular. So now you know why Plato's theory never was popular and why the other ones are. It really appeals to us as the center of the universe, what our emotional need is. And we should be a little bit concerned that that emotional need is getting in the way of our thinking clearly. So now, let's turn it all around and say, God's personality. From God's personality point of view, what are the stories we tell about him? Is God a tyrant king? Pretty often. You know, even in the Bhagavad Gita that goes into great detail about yoga and Krishna is trying to explain to Arjuna everything. When Arjuna keeps asking questions after an hour and a half, he finally says, okay, here's who I am. And he gives them a vision of the whole universe and everything being swallowed and him destroying everything and creating everything and scares the hell out of him. And then Arjuna says, okay, I'll do what you say. So even when God is presented in a very, you know, even intellectual way, eventually it gets down to it. He's got the power. He's in charge. Just do what he says. Because that's the bottom line. Now, power was never imagined by people 3,000 years ago being used any other way than by a tyrant king. Because that's who was in charge. Now, why are tyrant kings tyrants? Because they've usurped power. They've stolen the power. They didn't deserve it. They talked their way into it with a bunch of followers and then told everybody that God told them that they could have it or whatever their story is, but they have usurped power. And therefore, their personalities are suspicious that people will find out that they don't deserve this. And so they got to keep everybody off balance. They got to do all kinds of things to keep the facade up. Now, in God's, if there were a God that was in charge and had all the power, nobody could take it away from him. Certainly none of us. Even if there was somebody called Satan who was very powerful, he's not going to take away from all-powerful person any power at all. So he can't be suspicious. He can't be tyrannical. His personality wouldn't develop in this way at all. It just doesn't make any sense. It makes sense from our point of view projecting out, because that's what we're used to in power, but if you turn it around, it doesn't make any sense that he'd behave that way. Because if you had all power, you're getting exactly what you want at all times. Therefore, you're going to be happy all the time. You'll never be unhappy. Now, it gets confusing because we look at the world and we say, how could he possibly want that? What does he want from all this suffering? What does he want from all this cruelty? And so we have to make up an explanation. And so in our attempt to be rational about the thing, we forget about the rationality of the first principles and we try to stitch together a story that makes enough sense that we can buy the story about what's going on. But if you look at it from his personality point of view, from where do these things come from? Let's talk about cruelty for a second. Okay. Why are we cruel? What is the pattern in our cruelty? I'll go through it real quickly. But we are cruel because we are suffering. And we want somebody else to suffer more than we do so that we can feel we're still more important than they are, because we always want to be more important than everybody else because we're the center of the universe. Right? And so, in order to make somebody suffer more, we need to make them suffer. Because otherwise, they're not going to suffer as much as we are. And people who are cruel often are in their worst, especially relatively good people, they're cruel when they are suffering the most. Somebody loses their job, they go home and hit their wife for the first time in 25 years. Because they just got hit, they want to hit somebody else, make them suffer more. But why they choose their wife doesn't make any sense. But that's, you have to make somebody else suffer more. Now, the great irony of this is that we learned to take pleasure from the pain of other people because it makes us feel more important. It's very terrible. That's the way we are. That's where cruelty comes from. It's all of us making those decisions. It's not inherent in the world or anything like that. But we'd have to be extremely clever to think and desire in a way which would end that. Now, because you see, if that really is the pattern, if that explanation is the real pattern behind all cruelty, there is absolutely no reason for God to be cruel. Why would he ever punish anybody? Why would he ever want to see anybody suffer? No, he wouldn't. Now, this gets very complicated in a way because he has created all of us according to the theory. And according to the theory, those who succeed get to go to heaven and be happy forever, and those who fail go to hell, and some go to limbo, and there's a whole bunch of qualifications in there, but the qualifications don't matter. What matters is that he's capable, because he can do anything, and he has done it, he has made some personalities that can succeed at this game. There's absolutely no reason he couldn't make every person succeed at the game, because he can do anything he wants. So why would he make any personalities that don't succeed at the game? Why would he do that? Well, we have a different reason coming at it, but if you look at it from God's point of view, we'd say, no, you know, I can make this whole range of personality, and I do. Okay, and, you know, it depends on the religion. There's either a tiny little slice that wins, a big slice that wins, you know, half the slice that wins. Almost everybody wins, only the paranoids don't get in. You know, everybody might have a different explanation, but everybody slices it someplace and says, these are the winners and these are the losers. Because if you're not a winner, you're not as important as you are if you're a loser. And so you want to be a winner, you want to be more important. So the thinner you slice it, the more important you are as the group, right? But if no matter how thin you slice it, he's capable of making those personalities that are winners, he's certainly capable of making every mind that ever existed exactly that good so that they could get into them. Because, you know, if you all had wonderful parents and the right personality, everybody would go to heaven. So, from his point of view, we have no explanation from that, except for that he is a cruel person, or he doesn't like to use his skills, or he's lazy, you know, maybe rested on the seventh day a little too long. There's all kinds of ways you could finesse it, but we're not looking at it from the personality of God's point of view when we're trying to explain things. And that also gives away the game that we are actually trying to explain it from our point of view, from our emotional point of view. So I can leave a little time for questions and answers. My conclusion is very, very simple. First, one of the things that we think about a lot is that the idea of God is basically our own hope to have all power and all knowledge so we can get whatever we desire. Right? But we really don't want to get everything that we desire. Right? We really ought not to. What we really be looking for is wisdom, to be able to choose what intelligent desires there would be so that we get good quality happiness. Wisdom is far more valuable than either power or knowledge, because wisdom will give us the information we need of how to make our decisions so that we can make ourselves a happy life. Desire is not the source of all suffering. Stupid desiring is. We go about desiring things that are getting our way. Even if we got what we wanted, we wouldn't get it. It's much more complicated than that. There's not time for that. But the conclusion is pretty simple. It's logically impossible for any mind to be omniscient or omnipotent. Logically impossible. Nobody can know everything, because all kinds of knowledge is fundamental to you. You can never know what it's like to know English and not know English at the same time. Knowledge is an experiential thing. There are all kinds of limits on knowledge. And if we have any knowledge, then God can't have all knowledge. Right? So there is no such thing as a mind that has it. Now let's drop that argument and say there is a mind that has all that, even though we think it's logically impossible. Anybody who's like that would behave totally differently than any of the stories that have ever been told about him. He would not mind whatever we did. If he created, he can't be against it. He might feel sorry for how we misuse our free will, but he probably likes it enough that that's okay. And there is no reason to fear him, because he can't make us unhappy. He's not in the business of making us unhappy, unless he's a cruel person, in which case, it's a being who's cruel, who's in charge of the universe. Now what are you going to do? Let's just say that there is a being who's cruel, who's in charge of the universe. What's your best strategy? Okay? That just sounds like Satan, right? So let's just say Satan's in charge of the universe. What's your best strategy? Well, one of the things I conclude is you can send a man to hell, but you can't make him suffer. Okay? So if we're all in hell together, we still don't have to suffer. You can get around. It's a little bit like being in the Soviet Union. I mean, they're in charge. You know, in the provinces, whenever you know, central authority whipped, you know, got out their whips, everybody says, sure, whatever you want us to do. And as soon as they turned their backs, they went back to doing exactly what they wanted to. So there is a strategy of dealing with the universe, even if there's a cruel being that's in charge of the whole thing. Since he's not omniscient, can't possibly keep track of all of us. You just stay in the provinces and enjoy yourself as long as you can and do what he says when the whip is cracked. So there's absolutely... See, part of my analysis is very simple. Whether God exists or he doesn't exist, it doesn't make any difference. It will not make any difference to our pursuit of happiness. There is nothing to fear from either one. And the same thing is true for death. If you say, what are the possibilities with death? Well, another big thing that we're afraid of. There are only two possibilities. Either we still exist or we don't exist. Right? If we don't exist, we're not there to be upset about the fact that we don't exist anymore. There is no unhappiness if we don't exist, right? And we're talking about fear is the anticipation of unhappiness. Okay? That's my pattern that I see in that. And so if there's no unhappiness, there's no reason to anticipate that you're going to experience unhappiness. In fact, you can anticipate no unhappiness, no happiness, nothing. I no longer exist. And if you still do exist, you're going to just keep experiencing life the way you've already done it anyway. In which case, you know, see to your personality now, because that's all that's crucial. So there's nothing to fear. You're going to be just as happy or unhappy if you still exist afterwards. And so there's nothing to fear. Those are the two possibilities. And if you're totally changed by death into a totally different personality, you won't recognize yourself. There'll be no, you know, nothing to connect you with who you were, and so that doesn't matter either. So those are the only possibilities. You don't want to be afraid of death. There's no reason to be afraid of God, whether he exists or he doesn't exist. Now, that takes away a lot of big fears. Right? And my point is real simple, that the inherent explanation of life is going to help us figure out how to pursue happiness much more effectively than before. And we have been scaring ourselves silly over something that really there is no real logical reason to be afraid of it, no matter what the answer is, and we probably will never answer those questions. And then some people worry, well, if we only live one life, and then the human race dies, and then all life dies, or we destroy this planet, and this is the only place that there was life. Life was an accident, as the scientists tell us. We're going to destroy this planet. All life goes away. That will really be unhappy. Well, if we're all gone, including all the animals, there are no minds left to be unhappy about the fact, and the universe is back to just being, you know, dead moons and dead suns and so on. There's no life to experience it. That's the difference between existence and experience. And, of course, we're experiencers, so we have a really big emotional, you know, feeling for experiencers and wish that experiencers could keep going because that means we could keep going. And I think the logic actually implies that because there would be no order in the universe outside of the normal patterns. There'd be no anti-entropy in the world if there weren't deciders moving things around. So I think deciders are a part of the whole thing. But it doesn't make any difference. And when we can conclude that those big issues can be decided either way and you can still make the same choices about life, our fears will diminish tremendously. So, part of my theory, the final conclusion is that you can all now go to Las Vegas and bet against Pascal's wager. Because Pascal's wager was that, you know, you either God exists or he doesn't exist. And it makes sense to believe in God because you get a big advantage if you believe in God because he's going to put you in heaven. And I'm saying that actually is no faith in God at all. It's a very weak faith in God just to say he exists and to say, but he's got a terrible personality. So if you assume that he exists and believe that he exists, at least give him credit for a personality better than the best human being, and the best human being would never do such a thing to everybody else. Because there's no point to it. There's no point to it. It's not going to make anybody better because the punishment lasts forever. So it's not even rehabilitation. So you can all go to Las Vegas and bet against Pascal's wager because even though a lot of people have thought, well, that's a good wager to take, it actually is an advantage to say, you know, there probably isn't God. And if there is, it won't make any difference in the way I pursue my life. And the irony, of course, is that if God has any kind of a decent personality, which he must have if he created this stuff with so much order, so many beauty, so much interesting, so many interesting things. If he does exist and he did create the order, what is he going to take as a compliment? Somebody getting down and being afraid of him? Or somebody saying, hey, you're really something? Nice job. And I'm going to try to figure it out. And if I get it wrong, I'm sure you won't mind because you didn't give me enough intelligence to figure it out, did you? And you know that. But it's a compliment to try to understand it in science or any other way. And, you know, what if life is all one big test to see what kind of an opinion we'll develop about God's personality? Then everybody who's afraid of him is going to fail. Maybe they'll get punished. Probably not. So, anybody want to buy tickets to Las Vegas? I've got no. So, that's the end of my lecture, but I'll take questions and answer, and they'll go a little bit longer, and I have something to pass out, which is, in one sheet, the inherent structure of our minds, the way that they work. 2 years ago, I gave a lecture here called The Patterns of Our Personalities, in which I talked about this. It's on podcast if anybody wants to listen to it. And a year ago, I give a lecture every year. It was on time and eternity if you wanted to go into the time and eternity a little bit longer. Go ahead.
Now, please address the standard answer to your conundrum about how could a God be good and allow evil in the world.
Right.
Which is, normally they say, well, because free will.
Free will,
somehow is so high that that's why God is doing it.
Right. So, my answer to that question is very simple. First, I say that most likely God doesn't exist and did not create the world, and that life is an eternal democracy. That we are all in this together, and that our individual minds probably are also eternal. That is, they're uninfluenced by change. Our personalities change over time and stuff like that. But we might be just like Adam's. Maybe not. It doesn't make any difference. But we live in the continual present all the time. Where does evil come from? I said evil to me is cruelty. Individual minds taking pleasure in causing pain in other people. And why do we do it? I explained it. Because we're trying to make ourselves in better shape than they are. One of the great ironies of that is that if you want to only hang around other people that are in worse shape than you are, so that you can feel good about being more important, you're going to, depending on how bad you feel, you're going to have to be with pretty lousy people. And if you want to be around really good people, you shouldn't need to make them suffer more than you suffer. You should be happy to be around people who are suffering less than you are. Cruelty, this pursuit of pleasure, is really one of the stupider versions of trying to get happiness. Because I call it a dependent, destructive desire. The quality is dependent and destructive. It depends, not only is it destructive to your own life, but it depends upon the other people cooperating. If you're cruel to somebody else, and they laugh at you, you're trying to make them suffer, and they laugh it off and walk away, that just makes you mad. You're in worse shape. And that actually is always the best defense against somebody trying to make you suffer, is to laugh it off and walk away, because that puts it back on them.
So two rather unrelated questions. The first one is about the idea of a concept that Plato and Pythagoras talked about. And how do you see that relating to Plato's thinking about the forms?
The form, yeah.
And then the second question, completely unrelated. So we talk about the center, us conceiving ourselves as the centers of the universe or wanting to be. How do you see that applying to your first discussion, or for, I guess, the first quarter of your discussion about science? So does science make us also feel like centers of the universe?
Yeah.
And if so, in which way?
Yeah, no, I don't think science does. I think that's why it's not popular. And I predicted a very successful theory would be one that merged the first two deterministic theories, the science theory with the absolute God theory. Said it's all determined, but that there's a God who makes us the center of the universe, and that we're still figuring out all the science, and is totally in favor of scientific investigation at the same time, because you're not going to stop scientific investigation as part of our culture. You know, that'll be extremely hard to do. So a possibly popular, would be a merger of those two ideas, because science does not make us feel like we're the center of the universe at all. In fact, part of it is making us feel less and less. On the other hand, we are the center of our universe. That's why we feel that way emotionally. All of our experience is going on in our own heads. We perceive what's going on. I'll give you a good example of why our minds are a little bit different, and probably are different than our bodies, and why there's a difference between mind and matter. Right? You're driving down the street, you're listening to the radio, and suddenly some traffic event takes place that you have to focus on and concentrate on. So you focus on it for a while, and then you suddenly, you know, realize everything's, you know, fine again, and what happens? You suddenly hear the radio again. During that whole time, you didn't hear the radio. But why? Because you were focused. Your mind went to what you needed to know. All that information was still going into your ears from the radio, but you didn't hear it at all. Because your mind, your body, heard every single bit of it, but your mind said, I don't have any intention or attention for that at all. Another example of the same thing, only in a little more profound way, when someone's dying. People, when they're dying, if they find out that their children are on their way to see them, many people who should die or physically would die can hang on for days or even a week if they know a child is coming. The child arrives, they say goodbye to the child, they die within an hour or two. Happens all the time. Both of those events happen all the time. It shows that the mind is somewhat different than the body. Okay? Probably. Of course, that doesn't really answer the big question either, because even if the mind is different from the body, that doesn't mean it's eternal either, because you could have a mind that was made out of some substance, say it's light, and the mind comes into the body like a lot of the reincarnationists believe, and then it lasts for a billion years, and then it dies. It still might not be eternal. And the difference between a billion years and 60 years is almost no difference when it comes to the substantive ideas. But on the other hand, you know, for those who are Christian and believe that they're going to go to heaven and that's going to last forever, no, you have to read your Bible a little bit more carefully. Because in Matthew, Jesus even said, heaven and earth shall pass away, but only my words will not pass away. So he already said heaven's going to pass away. And the other story that's even scarier that's in the Bible is Satan and all of his angels are archangels. You know, he's an archangel in heaven. He's been there forever. He decides to say no to God, and the next day he's out, along with one third of the angels, right? Now they're in hell. So if he can get kicked out of heaven, where is your confidence that you get to stay there? Yes, Jojo. Right.
And I'd like you to comment on how the media, every day, and every channel, in every newspaper, is giving us this propaganda of fear. Maybe you'll say that's the way to control us. I don't know.
I don't think it's, I don't think it's to control us, because it's not necessary. We like that fear. We go to pay for scary movies, right? We pay people to scare us. There's even people who... There's even people who get in cages. Have you ever heard of this? They get in a cage in Australia, in the waters off Australia, and get lowered down into the water with raw meat in there and blood so that the sharks will attack the cage but not actually kill them. No, I mean, I don't know how much they pay for that, but it's not high on my list of things to do. But people do. Because why? Because people feel alive when they're afraid, because their adrenaline starts moving, right? That's what they like about fear. That's what they like about the scary movies that are actually safe, right? And why do they want that? Because they want to feel alive. But you can feel alive if you get rid of all these other deadening fears that I was talking about that are in our way. You can feel alive every moment of every day, all the time. Eric.
First of all, I just want to say it's a wonder you can sleep at night with all these ideas. spinning around.
I actually sleep very well.
I'm impressed. Actually, I just have a comment to make, and you're welcome to comment back on it. Just going back to your question about the meaning of life, I spent half of your talk just writing down my own ideas of what I felt the meaning of life was. Mm-hmm. My best summary I can come up with is that the meaning of life is to love, and that's something that happens here and now, and that I assume will happen forever. And I think it's that ability to love that constitutes the proverbial heaven within that we read about in the New Testament. And in that same New Testament, we read that God is love. And for me, that's how I know God exists. It's in my own ability to love and what I see in others of their ability to love, even under the most adverse circumstances imaginable. So, like I say, welcome to comment or not on that.
Right. I'm happy to comment on that. It's a great, great question. The emotions have mystified everybody. And the reason why is because there doesn't seem to be a pattern to them. They're all mixed together. But when I got this idea about how to look for the structure that's inherent, I came up with the definitions of the emotions. You'll see them all on the piece of paper that you have. So love, I define as the emotion caused by the attraction to beauty. Now, I didn't have time to say everything, but beauty is what we see, the quality we see in somebody else or something else that is the promise of happiness. So, essentially, love is our attraction to the promise of happiness. And so God, in this case, stands in for that. Now, the reason I wouldn't say God is love is fairly simple, because I'm looking at this from a different point of view. Our emotions are experienced in our own minds. They are passive mental experiences. And so I don't see love as existing outside of any individual mind, but it's an emotional reaction inside every single mind, including animals, every mind. Okay? But in a sense, what you said is fairly close to what I think the inherent structure is, and that is that we're going for happiness. All our desires are structured to go for happiness. Happiness is the emotion caused by the fulfillment of a desire. So we want that experience. That's where what our minds are after. Our minds intellectually pursue desires because they're supposed to give us happiness. The complicating factor, as I mentioned, is that our motives are our real desires. And we usually have hundreds of motives for each of our real desires. And they can't all be satisfied when we satisfy the desire. Some of them will conflict with each other. And so we're never getting pure happiness. The purest form of happiness is probably watching children play. They don't have anything else on their mind but the fun of playing. And so they don't have a bunch of motives. They don't care whether the neighbors watch them have fun or not. No. They don't care whether it gives them any status in society. All the other things that, some of our desires will go one way or the other on. So if that's true, then what you're saying is very similar. That is, that we, and this is true, if you ask people at the end of their lives what was really important to them, usually it is somebody trusted me, or somebody loved me, somebody reacted to me with one of these very positive emotions. that we all experience. Why? Because that means, if my analysis is correct, that means that we were a source of happiness for them and they knew it. They felt it, they knew it. And so we were improving on their lives by being their friend or their wife or their husband or their child. And so you can do this with total strangers. You can do it with anybody. It's very simple. People will love you if you make them happy. It's that simple. You have to be very clever because they're very complicated in their approach to their happiness. They may say they want one thing, but what they really want is something else. And unless you figure out what they really want, you're only going to make the minority view of their desire happy and not the majority view. And so you can try to make somebody happy and the kid will still be furious with you because they didn't. I'll give you a good example from the life of a religious family. You know, the mother wanted the children very badly, loved all of her children, but she thought every single one of those children was a gift from God. That's what made her happy with those children. But the children wanted to be loved as their own personalities. Well, some of those personalities were not the kind that the mother liked. Okay? And so the love of the mother was not for the personality, but just for the simple fact that it was a child given to her by God. So the child wants the love of the parent. The mother says, I love you. The child says, I don't see it. Because the child doesn't see the love being directed at their personality. It's being directed at their fact of being there. That's not usually good enough for most people. And of course, there's all kinds of subtleties. I mean, I'm trying to hint at the subtleties in a short amount of time. But there's a lot of subtlety to it. But the basic principle is very, very similar. You find yourself being happier yourself by creating love in other people. There's no question about it. Because it's all connected to happiness. It's all connected to the attraction. And the same thing with anger. Anger and patience. It's all kind of related to the same thing. We get angry because we reject reality. Well, people say you should get angry at the way reality is. That's true. But patience is the emotional acceptance of reality. And to do anything tremendous in human culture or anything, you need a tremendous amount of patience because unless you think that you can change everyone's mind by dictating to people, that's just never going to happen. And people have their own wills, their own experiences, their own approach. You know, there aren't 100,000 people in here wanting to hear about philosophy because only a few people have any interest in it because most people, it gives them headaches. Right? I mean, as you can tell from this lecture, I've had dinners, especially when I first had these ideas in my 20s, I used to have dinner parties. And I would start talking and we would discuss ideas and I could go for hours and hours. Every once in a while someone would get up from the table and go as far away in the room as they could, cover their head and say, you know, doesn't this give you a headache to think about these things? So the basic thing is, you know, and also, because I did a lot of the work in my 20s on this, my enthusiasm for the ideas was tremendous because I could see they were extremely rational and that they could actually explain things. Instead of complaining about the way things are, I could explain the way they are and people can make their own mind up about it. But, you know, at first I thought, well, that's easy. I'll just take everybody, sit them down for 10 hours, and at the end of the 10 hours, they'll walk away and have all the ideas I've thought of. I was disabused of that notion pretty quickly. I think as a result, you know, if it's so rational, I think it will take much, much longer. But I like Plato's approach. That was a very good approach to this. You know, you stick the ideas in there. All kinds of people pick and choose ideas from it and use them in their own way. But that everyone will adjust whatever you do to their own personality anyway. There's no, because we are the center of our own universe. And that's the way it should be. But we should become mature and realize, actually, there are billions and billions of other centers of the universe out there. And then we'll have a much better perspective on how to deal with them and how to deal with ourselves. We'll be closer in tune to reality. And we'll be able, if we're closer in tune to reality, we should be able to get happier than we were before. We'll make more intelligent desires. I'll take one more question, then I'll stay and answer any more questions after that, but we have to cut off the tape. Yeah.
With your ideas, can you relate to the concept of altruism?
Of altruism?
Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, I mean, they talk about, well, there's a Darwinian reason for altruism. I always find that very interesting. See, you know, it's not that much fun to be all alone in the universe. I mean, people have talked about that, about God, too. You know, what, is he all alone in the universe? That's why he made all of us, right? Because he was all alone. But that, of course, gives, you know, that makes him kind of a lonely old man, and that's why he did it. That's not a really good, not a really good image either when you come down to it. But you know, how many people here find it more interesting? I mean, I know a lot of people are a pain in the neck, but it's fun to have a few friends that really can understand you and get at least a little glimpse of you. And I think that that's where altruism comes from. You want other people to be happy. You want to be a source of happiness for other people because that means you're going to be loved. You maybe don't know that clearly, but that's how you're loved. There, you don't need any Darwinian ideas about this at all. It's very clear from the way that our minds work that if you're intelligent about things, you're going to pursue what are called altruistic desires. What I say is that everybody is selfish all the time. Everyone always pursues their own selfish desires. But unselfishness is an intelligent form of selfishness. To be unselfish is a very intelligent form of being selfish because you're pursuing desires in a way which makes you even happier than the other people. And what's selfishness about but to make yourself happy? And if you look at it, if you look at it clearly, there is no explanation of life that has ever been offered, that has ever been popular, that didn't explain that the end goal was happiness. Because if nirvana is no fun, nobody wants to be there. If enlightenment is not, you know, going to be uniting with an absolute God and therefore you're set for all eternity, you don't want to be there. And if heaven is going to be no fun, you don't want to be there either. As Mark Twain said, heaven for climate, hell for company. So ends another event at the Commonwealth Club in its 111th year of enlightened discussion.